Welcome back to All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook. TV's Emmy nominations were unveiled this week. The big moment? Here's host Kristen Chenoweth.
The nominations in the drama series category are Boston Legal, Damages, Dexter, House, Lost, and Mad Men.
Mad Men got the big whoops Thursday and the most drama nominations, 16 of them. Huh. Never watched it? Never heard of it? Well, you're in good company. Mad Men only gets 1 million viewers a week. Compare that to American Idol's 30 million a week. Ed Bark, you're a TV critic. What's that about?
Well, it's up to the Emmy people to recognize quality above all else, regardless of a show's popularity. So that is their first job. A lot more basic cable networks such as AMC, this Mad Men was their first venture into an original scripted drama. This is suddenly the signature show of the network.
I thought this was the place where you saw black and white movies.
Yeah. Well, now they've got commercials and they've mostly gone to color and they've ruined the channel otherwise. So they might as well have Mad Men.
And Mad Men is about an advertising agency?
Yeah, it's about a Madison Avenue 1960s era ad agency.
What do you fellas do?
You're looking at the finest ad men in New York. Hell, the world.
Bringing in business is the key to your salary, your status, and your self-worth.
Sounds stylish.
A lot of cigarette smoking in that series, which, a broadcast network couldn't put on this series, I don't think.
Huh.
They couldn't. They certainly couldn't reflect what was the reality at the time. A lot of heavy straight liquor drinking and chain smoking.
The other leading Emmy shows are from the biggie networks, John Adams on HBO, 30 Rock on NBC, that stars Tina Fey. But these are not exactly rating superstars either.
No, John Adams didn't do any business when you compare it to The Sopranos or Sex and the City on HBO. And 30 Rock is NBC's lowest rated comedy, but it still set a single season record for comedy nominations with 17.
This is going to sound really weird, but you need to wear a bra.
Oh, no, I don't actually. They kind of just stay up on their own.
Yeah, okay. What I'm saying is
30 Rock has a 3.8 overall Nielsen rating. MASH in its heyday was doing a 27-point-something Nielsen rating.
Wow.
That means that 27% of all homes with television sets were watching MASH on a given episode.
Our program originates from the swamp, which is the subject of a picture spread in next month's Toilet and Garden.
A critic in the LA Times wrote that the network's comedies and dramas are, quote, becoming expensive diversions for the cultural elite, akin to opera in the 19th century.
That's a little bit of an overstatement. I mean, the nominees also include House, which is very popular, Boston Legal, which does pretty well. And the comedy nominees do include Two and a Half Men, which is the most watched comedy on network TV. The problem is there aren't many comedies at all on network TV anymore. There's just a much higher percentage of American Idols and Survivors. And
Greatest American Dog.
JD and Galaxy proved to be fierce competitors in the Dog Bone Challenge.
Greatest American Dog, it's fine. I mean, it's about, poor dog is trying to get ahead in the world. It's okay.
Maybe it has to do with your name. Ed Bark is a longtime TV
probably.
Critic. He runs the website UncleBarky.com. Thanks, Uncle Barky.
Hey, you're welcome. Thank you.
Nathan Hodge and his wife Sharon Weinberger are journalists who write about defense policy for a living. 2 years ago, for a vacation, they decided to tour the world of atomic weaponry. Their adventure took them to 10 U.S. states and 4 foreign countries, and their itinerary included a uranium conversion facility in Iran and the bunker thought to be the vice president's undisclosed location on 9/11. Naturally, they wrote a book about the trip. A Nuclear Family Vacation was recently published, and one half of the writing team joins us. Nathan Hodge, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, how did you arrange the trip? I mean, this kind of trip is not something a travel agent or a travel website can do easily.
Right. There's not a lot of top secret tourism out there. But, interestingly enough, as we traveled through the nuclear complex, we discovered that this is sort of a source of national pride for all the countries that, do possess sort of nuclear technology or nuclear know-how. And interestingly, we found that a lot of them have, for instance, open tours. You can go, for instance, to the public tours that all of the U.S. Department of Energy labs hold. They have them. I mean, you've got to sign up for them in advance, and I think there is some security screening involved. But you can go see them in places, destinations like the Trinity Atomic Test Site, the site of the first nuclear detonation down at White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico, is also a place that you can visit. They have a couple of public days a year.
What about in foreign countries, though, where you have places where nuclear activity goes on, and they're pretty much closed cities?
And Russia is the best example of that. Russia does still to this day have closed nuclear cities, which are basically cities behind a gate. It's nearly impossible for a foreigner to get in, although, you know, there are sort of government-to-government negotiations for access to, you know, very high-level delegations to visit. But surprisingly, we found, like in the case of Iran, they said that they wanted to open, as a gesture of transparency, their nuclear sites to tourism. So we took them up on it.
What'd you see?
Well, we went to a place called the Isfahan Uranium Conversion Facility. And we went there shortly after, basically, the Iranians had announced in late 2006 that, yes, they wanted to open their nuclear sites to show their peaceful intentions. So we were called on a Monday and said, can you be in Tehran by Saturday? It took a little bit of scrambling, but we did get visas. And we did get to see this facility. But the interesting thing was, the real controversy at the time surrounded a site called Natanz, where the work on enrichment is being done and where they were installing centrifuges. And when we asked to see that, well, the answer was, we'll get back to you, basically. Mm. But, you know, what they did want to show us in Iran was that there is a level of monitoring that is going on in these facilities by the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency. And they were very keen, for instance, to show us, you know, here's where the cameras are, that kind of thing. And that was sort of the big, sort of the culmination of the tour, where they take you into the room and everyone's scrambling for their photo opportunity.
Explain how it was that you visited the underground Pentagon, which is believed to be Vice President Cheney's undisclosed location during 9/11.
Well, the underground Pentagon, or Site R as it's known, just across the border in Pennsylvania, is one of the places where the closest we got was just outside the gate. Now, we visit a couple of bunkers, active bunkers, like the Cheyenne Mountain facility out in Colorado Springs. And we also went to a retired bunker. Fascinating place. I definitely recommend visiting it. And that's under the Greenbrier Resort in West Virginia. Mm-hmm. Now, you can just drive up there. It's kind of an open secret where Site R is located. But what we found, that was one of those cases where really, you know, we got usually a lot of help and a lot of doors were open. When we basically talked to people in Washington, none of our phone calls were returned about that. But we did manage to get a hold of some documents, which were very interesting, basically describing a bunker managers conference that was going on at Site R. So we did learn a little bit about what are some of the issues that are involved with managing these sites.
When you were touring, did you tell people you were reporters?
Absolutely.
You did?
Yeah. No, we were totally upfront with it. And you know, it was funny, especially when we were trying to get our visas to Iran, when, you know, we had published some series of articles about this for Slate magazine already. So our work was already online. People knew that we were nuclear vacationers. And in fact, at one point when we were touring the Isfahan facility, one of the members of sort of the Iranian official delegation that was there sidled up to Sharon and said, "Are you enjoying your nuclear family vacation?" And he was clearly adept at Google and knew what we were up to and sort of saw the humor in it that we saw it as well.
What inspired this atomic road trip in the first place?
We write about defense for a living, but we found that we didn't know a whole lot about the nuclear arsenal. How many warheads are out there? Are they still on full alert like they were during the days of confrontation with the Soviet Union? And we were sort of surprised at the beginning, at least, to find out, well, yes, they were. Part of our tour was actually to Warren Air Force Base, and we went down in an active missile capsule, and we talked with one of the crews that's still there pulling alert and ready to do the key turning operation if they're ordered to do so by the president. Mm. So that was really kind of sobering to think about the fact that we really haven't stood down this posture of hair trigger alerts.
Is there a sequel?
We talked a little bit about where would we go? What would be our next set of destinations? You know, obviously North Korea would be really high on the list. And we talked about doing that, and it seems like that would be highly unlikely. But, you know, for instance, if you were hypothetically to come up with a new nuclear itinerary, Obviously, India and Pakistan would be on the list as well. Another place that we didn't get to go, and you probably have a hard time getting to see, is Israel, which is understood to be a nuclear power, but is not a declared one. So, this is a very urgent issue, and that's why there's sort of all of this, massive tension surrounding Iran and its nuclear ambitions, because they have been less than forthcoming about what they're actually up to.
Nathan Hodge and his wife Sharon Weinberger are co-authors of the new book, A Nuclear Family Vacation: Travels in the World of Atomic Weaponry, published by Bloomsbury. Nathan, thanks for coming in.
Thanks.
Push a button, turn a dial. Your work is done for miles and miles. When it hits, bound to shake, because it feels like an earthquake. That's the drink that you don't pour. Now when you take one sip, you won't need any more. If you're small as a beetle or big as a whale, atomic cocktail.
And remember to check out our blog, npr.org/soapbox. We are still taking submissions for our series on race and politics built around the views of you, our listeners. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen, and we leave you with an excerpt from a video featured on our blog from Jib Jab, a political animation parody that is sure to elicit giggles from constituents of all political persuasions. Go to npr.org/soapbox. See the video.
Citizens gather from both far and near for a ritual we practice every 4 years, when we promise you anything you want to hear. To win the proud register, we spend billions of dollars to make our points clear, to get you to step up and cast your vote.
Usually when I talk to our movie critic, Bob Mondello, he's about 5 feet away, sitting right across from me in the studio. Today, he's 5,000 miles away at the BBC studios in Buenos Aires, Argentina. Bob, what's got you so worked up that you had to interrupt your vacation to tell me about it?
Oh, Batman.
Batman.
You got to flip out over Batman. You just have to.
And I understand, Bob, that you saw it at a theater Thursday in Argentina. And we had to wait till Friday here in the United States. It's a Hollywood movie.
I always assumed that these pictures only opened in other countries after, or maybe even the same day that they opened in the United States. But apparently that's not true. Friday was a school holiday here in Argentina. And so they opened it on Thursday to take advantage of all the kids who were going to be out of school, which makes excellent sense. And, of course, you'd expect them to do that, except that, there's always been that fear of piracy. They're so worried about the about the prince getting out ahead of time. And apparently that doesn't scare people quite as much as it once did. In fact, it opened in on Wednesday in Australia and Egypt and the Philippines. And as a result, Warner Brothers has had some $4.5 million U.S. dollars worth in the till just in Australia before it opened anywhere else in the world, including Argentina or the United States.
I just say that's no fair. So what was it called down there?
Well, it's The Dark Knight in English, and to suggest darkness, they do El Caballero de la Noche. Actually, they pronounce that Caballero here. Mm. El Caballero de la Noche, the gentleman of the night.
Hmm.
Very dark.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I have to say, it was frankly a little too dark for me.
Oh, really?
I do not appreciate being wrenched around as much as this movie
It happens a lot. On the other hand, it's a very exciting picture. And one of the things that's appealing about this is that they basically decided that they didn't have to worry about making a new comic book film, that they had to do something that was more substantial than that. It had to be a good movie. Hmm. And so it involves ideas. And so it goes into character. And with comic book movies, what you usually get is a lot of special effects. You get a lot of people getting thrown into walls, and then the walls break. And that kind of thing is unrealistic, but explosive. It's kind of cool to watch, but it makes comic book movies not interesting for people who don't already want to see that kind of stuff. Whereas this movie, I think, has enough with this whole notion of vigilantism and it being not a good thing, even when it's done by the guy we think of as the good guy. That he's still kind of in trouble legally when he's doing this stuff, that is an interesting concept, and that makes this movie more interesting than the typical superhero movie.
And relevant.
Yes, I agree.
Mm-hmm.
That's especially, you know, the Heath Ledger character, the Joker, could be regarded as a sort of
terrorist.
A terrorist,
mm-hmm.
right? And, and I think this is an interesting topic for movies generally. You know, other pictures have sort of alluded to that idea. There's a bit in The Iron Man that actually takes place in the Middle East. But this is much smarter about the way it does it.
True. I do enjoy the ideas. It's the violence that turns me off.
Well, there's a lot of violence in pictures these days. This one's rated PG-13, I think, which suggests that you have to be at least past your early teens. But it's a violent picture, and it's a dark one. I keep telling people that the little glimmers of light that you get, the twinkle in Michael Caine's eye and that kind of thing, those are not enough to dispel the overwhelming gloom of the picture. Mm-hmm. But it is exciting. It is about something. And I got to say, Heath Ledger's performance is just amazing.
That is true.
You know, he plays the Joker in here. It was the second to last performance, the last one that he actually completed before he died in January. It's just a riveting performance. And I think it's arguably not a supporting performance when it comes Oscar time. I suspect he'll be nominated for Best Actor.
NPR's Bob Mondello on vacation in Buenos Aires, but still watching movies. Here in North America, The Dark Knight had the biggest opening day ever yesterday. It made $66 million. That's almost $7 million more than the record set last year by Spider-Man 3. If you're planning on adding to those numbers this weekend, you might want to stay for the closing credits. They include a dedication to the memories of two people. One, of course, is Heath Ledger. The other, Conway Wycliffe. He was a special effects tech from New Zealand. He was killed last September during a rehearsal. Wycliffe was filming from the passenger seat of a car trailing the Batmobile. The driver lost control and hit a tree. The driver survived. Wycliffe did not. Special effects expert Matthew Johnson worked with Conway Wycliffe on a number of movies, including the last two James Bond flicks.
He was probably, I'd say, the best in welding and fabricating. He had a massive part to play in the first Batman, in the Batman Begins, the Batmobile. He built that car from scratch, designed from zero, so it's amazing when you actually see it on screen.
The Batmobile, oh my gosh, that thing is amazing.
Dearin Chase was Conway Wycliffe's partner for 22 years. She says his job wasn't dangerous. Normally, Wycliffe spent the day in a quiet workshop designing things. She spoke with him by phone only an hour before he died.
I said, oh, babe, what are you up to today? And he goes, oh, no, hun. You know, I did a big job on the Friday. He'd made a gadget on the Batman belt. You know, he goes, I'm just going to keep my head low and not volunteer for anything today. And unfortunately, I'm presuming they just asked him to film some things that happened on the day. And, he never came home.
Hundreds of people paid their respects at a wake in London, including Batman star Christian Bale. Mourners shared stories about their gregarious and fun-loving friend. Matthew Johnson was among them. He remembers a party after they wrapped the movie Tomb Raider 2. The tech crew partied at the Hard Rock Cafe in London.
We went down into the vault where they have all the memorabilia from, you know, Elvis's suit and the guitars and drums and you name it. It's all in there. And the guy went in, it was his own little private tour, you know. And he said, please don't touch anything. And the next minute we turn around and there's Conway sitting there with Jimi Hendrix guitar, man, just knocking out a tune. And because he was so good, the guy never said anything. He just let him crack on, you know. And he just like, okay, that was great. Now can you put it back, please?
Johnson says he and Wycliffe used to joke about how little respect the special effects guys get at the end of a film. They'd make bets about whether they'd even get in the credits at all.
He's definitely got a credit this time, that's for sure. And it's definitely a testament to the kind of guy that he was that he should have his name up there with Heath, I think. It's a nice touch.
Special effects technician Conway Wycliffe was killed on the set of The Dark Knight back in September. He was 41 years old.
Joining us in the studio for some analysis is Vali Nasser. He's with the Council on Foreign Relations. Welcome.
Thank you.
The Iranians have been very consistent for years. They won't compromise on enriching uranium. The U.S. insists they must for any progress to be achieved. Do you see any way to bridge this gap?
Down the road, it's possible, but only if you have a series of constructive engagements like the ones that we saw in Geneva, but more fruitful. If there is a path to diplomatic engagement, there could potentially be a change of behavior on the Iranian side.
The Iranians have said that they would form an international consortium to control the uranium enrichment facilities in Iran. And the EU proposal to Iran says it will guarantee nuclear fuel supply. Now, the Iranians are suspicious that any deal they might sign on to would be violated somewhere down the line. Is there any way, any assurances that the international community can give them?
Well, these talks are really at two levels. One is very narrowly about the nuclear issue and how they're going to get the fuel that they want for their nuclear program. The other one is about Iran getting security guarantees from the international community and seeing a path to normalization of relations with the U.S. And ultimately, Iranians are looking for that larger goal, whereas the Americans and the Europeans are looking for the narrower issues regarding the nuclear enrichment.
Could it be said, however, that the Iranian government may be trying to run out the clock on the Bush administration, avoid any possibility of a U.S. military strike until a new American administration takes over?
Well, the Iranians are clearly not interested in war. That's why they did the missile test as a deterrence to U.S. and Israel. And that's why you see a charm offensive in the language that they're using about these talks. But at the same time, I think they're interested in some kind of a deal with the international community that would consolidate their gains, but also show them a path forward towards normalization.
Vali Nasser, there's been some talk that the United States will establish an interest section in Tehran with American diplomats working there. What are your thoughts on this possibility?
Well, for practical reasons, it's a good idea. There are tens of thousands of Iranian Americans who travel to Iran routinely. There have been Iranian Americans that have been held in prison in Iran. Absence of a consular presence makes things difficult for the U.S. But also it would be a powerful signal that the United States and Iran would be moving in the direction of reestablishing diplomatic relations, which is, I think, something the Iranians would want, because ultimately only U.S. recognition of Iran at a diplomatic level would provide Iran with the kind of security guarantees that it's looking for.
Of course, some in the State Department fear that this would be very difficult to explain to the American public, and therefore it would be very difficult to implement.
There are many difficult things that the various U.S. administrations have had to explain to the American public, going back to establishing of relations with China, with Soviet Union, as well as also more recently the steps that have been taken in the direction of normalization of relations with North Korea. I think the same would be true of Iran.
Before I let you go in the brief time we have left, can I get your thoughts on Senator Barack Obama's trip to Afghanistan and his expected trip to Iraq?
I think it's very important, both in bringing Afghanistan to the center and the discussions about U.S. security and challenges that face the United States. But also, I think he enjoys enormous amount of popularity in both Iraq and Afghanistan, and it can give a much more latitude for American policy in the region.
Optimistic, pessimistic, one choice.
I think on some issues we can be optimistic, such as Iraq. On some issues like Afghanistan, we have to be extremely cautious.
Vali Nasser is the author of The Shia Revival and professor of international politics at Tufts University's Fletcher School of International Affairs. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.
And coming up later in the program, an American tours nuclear weapons facilities around the world as part of his vacation, including a uranium conversion facility in Iran. Stay tuned. You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. Every year, Americans reach for more and more wine. Last year, we drank enough to set a record for the nation, 304 million cases. We even surpassed Italians for the first time. That's thanks in part to the growing variety of wines. On our show last week, we asked accredited sommelier Natalie McLean to help us pair those wines with our favorite foods, like nachos.
A simple, berry-ripe red wine like a California Zinfandel.
This week, we continue our conversation with McLean about wine. She says the drink is changing as demand increases, but change isn't necessarily bad news.
The good news today is that there is so much competition around the world between new producers of wine, new regions. The new technology is allowing winemakers to make better wine at lower prices. And all of that means that we don't have to pay a lot of money anymore for delicious wine. Now, we're always going to pay super premium prices for brand name regions like Bordeaux, you know, your cult California Cabernets at the highest end, Burgundy, and so on. But if you look at value regions like South Africa, lesser known regions of California, Chile, Argentina, you're going to find spectacularly delicious wines in the $10 to $15 range.
Really?
Really. A lot of the value-priced wines, as they'd have us say it, are made to be consumed immediately. In fact, you know, most wines are consumed within about 17 minutes of purchase, the time it takes to drive home. So winemakers know that. 99% of wines today are not meant to be aged. So the wine style today is accessible, it's fruity, it's delicious, it's consistent, and it's cheap.
Is alcohol percentage a factor?
Yeah, alcohol affects wine profoundly. These days, wines on average seem to be getting higher and higher in their alcohol level. Some say it's global warming. Others just say that it's the market driving the wine style. People want more bang for their buck. So the winemakers are letting the grapes hang longer on the vines. That translates into more sugar in the grapes. Sugar is what makes alcohol. Hmm. In the old days, 10 years ago, maybe 10-12% was average for alcohol level. Now we're seeing 13 to 16%. I actually am very sensitive to that because when wines get that high in alcohol, the heat of the alcohol starts to overwhelm the other flavor elements in it.
You made an aside to climate change, perhaps affecting the increasing alcohol percentages. Do you find that climate change is affecting the wine industry in other ways? Are observations being made?
Absolutely. I was in Germany in September, and Germany is renowned for its ethereal, delicate Rieslings. They are usually or traditionally have been in the 7 to 9% alcohol range. But what's happening is that the alcohol levels are going up, but also there are no longer bad vintages, bad meaning the grapes didn't ripen enough or there was, you know, just too much rain. So overall, the vintages are getting riper. There's more sun, more warming of the grapes, and so on.
What about buying locally and organically? How do you go about finding something good?
Well, organic wines, for starters, are very well made these days. A lot of us still have the image of the bad old 70s when organic wines were
lighter fluid.
Yeah, exactly, if that. But these days, organic wines have to compete on taste. People buy primarily on taste and price. So I'm finding that the organic wines I taste these days are extremely well made. So the organic wine section of the liquor store is also one of the fastest growing. It's growing by 20% a year. I think there are some misperceptions about organic wines, that they're somehow a more healthful beverage. They are not, because fermentation takes care of all the pesticides. But when you buy organic wines, you're making a statement both for the environment and those who work on that winery, which is essentially a grape farm. Buying local is also a great thing. I mean, you know, there again, you're making a statement about the environment. It's supporting your local farmers. And, you know, there's so many pockets of great wineries, you know, these days, from Texas to Michigan to upper New York State. It's a great reason to explore what's in your own backyard.
Two quick fire questions. Favorite wine?
Oh, my goodness, the one someone else pays for. But
That's good. That's a great answer. Great okay. answer. All right, here's the other one. Which country produces the best wine?
Oh, you know, I'm a fan of Pinot Noir worldwide. So I love it from cool regions of California, Carneros, Russian River. I love it from Oregon. I love it from Burgundy. I'm such a fan of Pinot Noir, and it's becoming a cliche. I've got to, you know, redo my wine wardrobe ever since Sideways. It's old news, but I love the seductiveness of Pinot Noir. It packs so much flavor, and yet it's not heavy. Anyway,
I thought you were going to be diplomatic and say the country you're in. You know, when you drink. I mean, look, Natalie, give me a break. You have this book, Red, White, and Drunk All Over. You take us all around the world of wine. Mm. In your wildest dreams, did you ever think you'd make a living drinking wine and writing about it?
No, although I think everybody who starts into this business, whether you're writing about food or wine, comes in through a back door somehow. And it's about discovering a passion that you always thought would be a hobby. The people in this industry who make wine, they are often refugees from another industry. They, too, have found their passion, whether they're sommeliers or winemakers or retailers or whatever. And it's not just another product. I mean, you know, there's a reason we don't have orange juice critics. There's something in that glass that combines the hedonism, the sensuality, and the sheer buzz of it to make it something we love to talk about, write about, and, of course, drink.
You're reminding me of the song Wine Fodiote. Sommelier Natalie McLean is the author of Red, White, and Drunk All Over. She spoke to us from the studios of the CBC in Ottawa. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Leanne. Cheers.